Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 163, Exercise and the Brain, July 11th, 2008. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
There is just a flock of evidence for the benefits for depression, for anxiety, for panic disorder. You know, part of what the real overall message is that if you activate your brain with the exercise, you're going to release a lot of the neurotransmitters that we aim with in psychopharmacology, you know, our drugs that we use, serotonin drugs, dopamine drugs, norepinephrine drugs, all tend to try, we think, elevate the levels of these neurotransmitters. Well, exercise does that pretty quickly.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. John Rady. John J. Rady, M.D., is author of the new book, Spark, The Revolutionary New Science of Exercise and the Brain. Dr. Rady is also an associate clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and has a private practice in Cambridge, Massachusetts. For more than a decade, he's taught residents and Harvard medical students as the assistant director of resident training at the Massachusetts Mental Health Center. He continues to teach psychiatrists as a regular instructor in Harvard's continuing medical education program. And as a clinical researcher, he's published more than 60 papers in peer-reviewed journals in the fields of psychiatry and psychopharmacology. Since 1998, Dr. Rady has been selected each year as one of the best doctors in America by his peers. Recently, Dr. Rady was the recipient of the 2006 Excellence in Advocacy Award. Now, here's the interview. Dr. John Rady, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks for having me.
I guess we've known for a long time that exercise is good for our bodies, but your book suggests that there's been a revolution in terms of understanding the impact of exercise on our brain. Do I have that right?
You sure do. I think the way I tell people is that exercise is really for our brain, and all the nice side effects happen in the body because exercise does so much to promote brain health, equilibrium, improve the brain function better than anything that we know of.
Wow. Wow. It's interesting. How did you get into studying the impact of exercise on the brain?
Well, I did most of my training here in Boston, and I came in the middle of the marathon craze. So we were at the same time learning so much about the brain, and then with the marathoning and the whole business of endorphin rush came about, and we were all going out to exercise to raise our endorphins and improve our mood, etc. And so I became fascinated with it when I began seeing patients who had an injury and couldn't no longer train, and they would get depressed almost predictably. And then a number of patients came in who had been in marathon training all of their lives or some variation thereof, and who had to stop for aging injury of the knee or the ankle. They found that they for the first time in their life, couldn't pay attention after they sort of went through their depression and were back. Their mood was back to where it should be, and they could no longer focus like they used to and do all the kinds of things that they were able to do when they were, you know, running 6 to 7, 8 miles a day under an hour, you know, being in that kind of aerobically fit state that they could no longer, they no longer could do that, and that they were feeling like they had minimal brain dysfunction at that time, we called it, and so that got me started and very interested in ADD. But at the same time, I was attuned to the literature on how exercise helped with depression that came out of a number of areas, but certainly from Duke University, who was looking. It was the first real group to look at exercise as a treatment for cardiovascular problems and prevention. And they also said, hey, our people that we have training for their hearts are also have a much better mood, less stress, less hostility, less anxiety, and they began then to focus on that in the Department of Psychology and Psychiatry. So they began to do studies, and all the studies wore out that exercise had a direct impact on mood and stress and anxiety. So it became a very interesting pursuit of mine.
About when was that? When was that going on at Duke that they were starting to release?
Oh, that was in the late, throughout the 70s, really. Okay. Then in the 80s and 90s, it sort of moved from just the cardiac treatment or prevention to more of its impact on psychology, or they began to do studies on that and highlight the fact that this was a pretty good way of treating some of our psychiatric ailments. And then in 1999, they came up with a very, very important study that got lots of play for about 2 days, and then everybody quickly forgot about it, that exercise was as good as Zoloft in treating moderate depression. And so, as I say, that got a lot of press immediately, and New York Times, Newsweek, CNN, all over the place, but then quickly disappeared from anybody's thoughts or awareness. But not mine, because I was already hooked on exercise as a treatment for an important treatment for all kinds of psychiatric issues, and I had been on talking about it and reading about it and keeping up with the literature. And then in 95 there came a wonderful paper showing that exercise in fact was a great way to increase the brain's concentration of very important protein that we had just discovered some years before, called BDNF, or brain-derived neurotrophic factor. And I called Miracle Grow for the brain because it really is brain fertilizer. And that just piqued my interest no end. And as well, that started the whole field of neuroscience, including exercise, in their purview in a very, very big way.
Okay, I want to get into BDNF some more a little bit further along, but I want to make sure I understood. You yourself were a marathoner or still are a marathoner?
No. My knees never let me do it. Football injury, but I was always an exerciser. I played squash 3 times a week, and really from medical school on, I was in pretty good aerobic fitness in a variety of different ways, playing basketball and what have you. And then I began to try to do marathoning, and my wife was running the marathon, so I was trying to support that, but my knees couldn't take it. So.
Okay, well, I'm not surprised to hear about the kinds of physical activities you've been involved in, because at the end of the book, you describe your own exercise regimen, and it's pretty impressive. It made me wonder if you'd been a jock all your life, and it sounds like maybe you have been.
Oh, well, I grew up in Western Pennsylvania back when all the quarterbacks were flying out of there, and it was a pretty heavy sports area for everybody. And I was a nationally ranked—I mean, not nationally ranked, but I played in the nationals in tennis in high school, and played 3 sports a bunch of times throughout my high school career. So I was always very much into activity, for sure.
It's interesting. I frequently reflect on the way that everything that happens in our lives seems to come together and gets rolled into our work. And so it's interesting that, you know, this kind of history that you have in your personal life of involvement with physical activity somehow ends up also, you know, playing a role in your professional life much later on. Now, the Greeks The Greek ideal emphasized both physical prowess and accomplishment in the arts as an important component in developing its citizens and music and so on, as you know, and physical prowess. And yet it seems like PE and the arts are the first things that get cut back during tight times.
Exactly. And I think this is so misunderstood and misapplied. You know, if our mission really is to develop our children and not just educate them so they can pass tests, one needs to look at the whole range of activities and personal development that the arts and fitness really bring to the table. And I think, you know, the whole, now with the obesity crisis hard upon us and the diabetes crisis emanating from the obesity crisis amongst our children, there are people now paying attention not only to diet, but also to our level of unfitness.
Yes. Well, early in the book, you offer a case history of a high school in Illinois that made PE central to their program. You make a reference to that program throughout the book. So take us through that, if you will.
Oh, I could spend 3 hours talking about that wonderful high school. It's not just a high school. It's the whole school system. It's an evolved physical ed program over the 18 years, really, when one of the teachers in the junior high school, one of the junior high schools in this area that have 19,000 children, we're talking, in this whole school system. But he decided that he wasn't doing his job because his kids were getting talked about as being more and more unfit. And so he began to say, okay, we have to switch our focus from sports to fitness. And then over the years sort of developed, fine-tuned that and reintroduced sports. But first people were just running and playing very heavy activity games. And then they brought sports back in, but still paid attention to managing the level of fitness in a big, big way. And then infected the high school and then the other high school and then the other junior highs. And so they all began to develop this program that now is second to none that I'm aware of. And I got interested in it because I heard about it in 2002, and their statistics were phenomenal, in that 3% of their children were considered overweight. Not obese, but overweight. 3% of 19,000 kids, that's pretty impressive. Then, at that same year, their eighth graders, all 96% of them, took the International Science and Math Test, which is called the TIMSS test, which countries take and compete with one another. And the U.S. is always ranked in the teens somewhere, in Hong Kong and Taiwan and Singapore are always up in the top five or so in science and math. Well, these eighth graders took it and they came in number one in the world in science and
Amazing.
Number six in math. Yes. And so even though they spend 45 minutes a day in fitness training, basically, with sports included, of course, they weren't suffering in their academic pursuits.
This all took place in Naperville, is that right? Naperville, Illinois?
Naperville, Illinois, yep.
And so it
evolved over an 18-year period of time. It just wasn't like, you know, set upon them. The phys ed faculty became relevant. And they just weren't sports teachers or sports leaders or coaches, even though they continued to have very high sports profile in their leagues. But all the kids were included in this program. I mean, all, and it wasn't preferentially for the design for the athletes. It was for everybody to pay attention. The big move was to get cardiac monitors or heart rate monitors for each of the kids back 17, 18 years ago in one class where they've got 30 of them, and they began to use that as a marker for their grade, is if you could remain in your zone, in your own zone, for a certain period of the week, then your grade was dependent on that. And this then has been a cornerstone of their program to do that, but now they've introduced all kinds of very creative ways of keeping the kids moving, and everybody's moving all the time in their sports. It's 2-on-2, 3-on-3, 4-on-4. They've now taken on a flourish of being the neuroscience experts in the school. So it's really, really been quite an interesting transition. And they certainly don't look like the old style gym teachers that we think of.
Yeah. Yeah. And as I listen to you, I'm realizing that sports and fitness are not necessarily the same thing.
Right. Absolutely. Sports is adds that competitive element, and it's not, and if you think about playing on a sports team, if you're not playing, you're not really getting much of the fitness perspective
right
there, and if you're sitting on the bench. So they said, okay, we can't depend on just, you know, everybody going and doing a sport, although that's fine if they are, you know, and playing and participating, but they switched the whole focus to fitness first.
Yes, and I like that use of the heart monitors, so that it sounds like the kids were competing with themselves, not with other kids. That is, they were trying to better their own personal scores.
Absolutely, and that's sort of been the, you know, from that, as I say, it's the cornerstone of the program, where everybody can achieve excellence in against themselves from the beginning. So people that are overweight to begin with, or, you know, when they come in sixth grade, or they or really aren't very fit, they will have a certain heart rate that they continue to maintain, and then eventually that will lead to more fitness and more work done by getting their heart rate into that zone. So it's inevitable that eventually they'll raise their level of fitness, and they found that this is indeed what happens.
Well, that sounds like such a wonderful development, because I remember when I was in school that for many people, PE was like their least favorite class, and it was humiliating, you know, for the fat kid who couldn't pull himself up the rope, or, you know, people who had various kinds of problems. And it sounds like this is a very different approach.
Oh, God, it's completely, it blew me away, and it continues to blow me away, and my hair stands up every time I talk about it, because it is such a change agent there for me, and that really solidified I've always been tinkering in all the books that I've written, and Driven to Distraction, and Answers, and then in User's Guide to the Brain, we emphasize, Dr. Howell and I emphasize the importance of exercise as an important part of the treatment and of any psychiatric problem, but certainly for the attention problems. And so I've always been gripped with that, and had started to work on a book many times over the years. But then when this program, Naperville, came my way, and I just said, okay, this is really the motivation to start really exploring, and I spent 2.5 years, like reading 2 gigabytes of PDFs on neuroscience and exercise. So, and then used a magazine editor, Eric Hagerman, to ghostwrite it for me. In other words, I would tell him, we would go over what I wanted to say, and then he would have to understand what I was telling him to be able to write it.
Sure.
So that it wasn't coming from my academies background, and it wasn't, it was something that I had to make him understand before he could write about it. So,
well, in fact, it does read very well, and there's a lot of good science in it, and it reads very well. And, you know, it seems to me that there, I hope these ideas really spread, and it does seem like it's an uphill battle, as you pointed out. The exercise over Zoloft advantage made the news for about 2 days and disappeared. And I'm guessing that on the one hand, a lot of this stuff is very politicized, you know, like raising test grades in the schools and concentrating on the three R's. It's always this political hot potato on the one hand. And then on the other hand, you have the pharmaceutical companies who have a lot of money invested interest in pills versus something that we have built in, like the ability to work on our fitness.
Exactly. I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think our whole ethos in medicine is sort of dominated by that antibiotic approach, which is there was a cure for disorders that for bacterial problems, right? I mean, you'd wipe it out with an antibiotic, and that began to pervade all of our thinking about using medicine. And we have that today even in psychiatry, where we're affecting the brain, and we know darn well that most of the drugs that we use are accidents. We came upon them accidentally, and I'm a very big prescriber of medicine, so I'm talking not as someone who flails away directly and all the time at the industry, but it certainly has been pervasive and has changed the way we look at psychiatric and brain problems in perhaps a way that we need to redo. And the wellness concept is growing and burgeoning all over the place, and not just in the schools, but in mental health centers and treatment areas. And now there's all this interest in exercise as a prevention treatment, for instance, for substance abuse. There was a big conference at National Institute of Drug Abuse just a few weeks ago that I attended that was about that, they've allocated a whole bunch of money to say, okay, how can we, what forms of exercise, what can we do? Let's study this to see if this we can begin to cut into the addiction problem that we have in every country.
Yes. You mentioned BDNF earlier as kind of the brain fertilizer, endogenous brain fertilizer. And I was interested to read that there was an important interaction of BDNF in the hippocampus, because I recently interviewed Sue Halpern. I don't know if you know her work, but she's written a new book on memory. And it seems that the problems of both Alzheimer's and normal memory loss due to aging have to do with molecules in the hippocampus.
Yes, and that's one of the big sort of tie-ups with exercise. Why neuroscience is abuzz about exercise and have been for the past 10 years, ever since the initial study came out, because we know that we're almost certain there's not many other things that are better than exercise for raising the level of BDNF, which is seen as the fertilizer for our brain cells, makes them more pliable, makes them more able to do their job, helps with their resilience so they withstand the stresses and aging and being beaten around by disuse and all. And also the big news is in the past 6 or 7 years is how we make our own new nerve cells every day, and specifically in the hippocampus, and that from stem cells, pardon George Bush, but despite that,
yes.
we have stem cells in our brain, and this BDNF is one of those important proteins or moieties that are there to help these stem cells to grow into brand new brain cells. And there's all this debate whether or not you need a new nerve cell to have a really solidify new memory or not. I mean, we're making a lot every day as we're losing some others, but that's for future analysis.
Okay, and you suggest that BDNF affects not just the learning, but also the rate of learning.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, it makes our cells do what they're supposed to do, which is learning means, it's not just in the hippocampus, but all throughout the brain. Learning means that you wire your cells together in a cell assembly, so you have a couple million, billion cells involved in the concept of a red wagon, for instance. Okay, they have that concept solidified, you practice the image and the label, and they're all different parts of the brain that come together, but they're all wired up, meaning that they are selectively connected one to another. So, and the more you practice, the harder the wiring gets. And BDNF is an important element in helping that, to helping the cells to be ready to learn new concepts and to develop new skills, etc. It's also, by the way, one of the, in the past 5 years, one of the areas that people looking at manic depressive disorder or bipolar disorder and unipolar depression or serious depression are very interested in this, because one of the things we know is that in those states of depression, serious depression, you see a decrease in BDNF, an increase in stress, and a decrease, an eroding of the brain. And with treatment, with an antidepressant or with ECT shock therapy or with exercise, you see a return to normal, if you will, of the brain's ability to learn and develop, and you actually see brain growth, regrowth.
Wow, that's great. That's incredible. You've made reference here a couple of times to what I guess is called neurogenesis or brain plasticity. And
no, they're not the same.
Oh, they're
brain
not the
plasticity.
Same.
Oh no, brain plasticity is the ability of our cells to change. That's what neuroplasticity is about: the nerve cells to change and grow. Neurogenesis means a brand new nerve cell, and it's very sexy because we didn't know until 1999 that we could do this in humans, that we actually, this occurred, because when we were in medical school and all throughout my career, we were taught, and the mantra was that you're born with a certain amount of brain cells at birth, and you start losing them right away, and there's no recovery, and there's no change, and but it's very, very different, and people make that confusion because neurogenesis is so darn sexy that everybody wants to equate the two, and it's far from being equivalent.
Okay, but they're both very important and
absolutely
and hopeful processes.
Oh yeah, no, I think the way to think of it is that neurogenesis is sort of the queen of neuroplasticity. In other words, that's the ultimate in neuroplasticity, making these new stuff.
Yeah, in the book you pointed out that there used to be public service announcements warning that alcohol kills brain cells and that they would never grow back. Now, we don't want to encourage anybody to become an alcoholic, because now we know brain cells can grow back, right?
Yes, they can go back, but we don't want to encourage that. That's not the point.
Right. On page 53, you say exercise improves learning on three levels. Can you take us through those three levels?
Well, the first is that it helps. The very first level is that it makes for a better learner. That is, it makes the learner less impulsive, that is, less fidgety, makes them more focused, improves their motivation to learn, improves their ability to overcome frustration, too. And all this is based in science. It's not just like observation and good thinking about it, but it's in science with rats and mice and all. And we know, and people, and we know this happens. So that they're after a bout of exercise and or with increasing levels of aerobic fitness, you have a better learner sitting in their chair. I'm thinking of the school student, but also even in business or even in life for all of us.
Yes.
Then you have an increase in neuroplasticity or brain plasticity in general. That is, you get the cells, you provide the absolute right environment for our cells to do what they're supposed to do, which is to bind to one another so we can adapt to the world. Think about it from an evolutionary perspective. That's what gives us, our brain is such a great gift to help us adapt to new environments, which, translation, learning. And that we learn when we change our brain, when our brains are changed, when our nerve cells are connected more one to another, to lock in that red wagon construct. Then the third way is this new area of neurogenesis or new brain cells that we grow. And that's the real, as I say, sexy and exciting part.
So there's so many benefits to exercise in broad strokes, the three that you just mentioned. What kind of exercise is best? That's what people are going to wonder. Well, what kind of exercise should I be doing? How often? To what intensity?
The most important thing is to do something that you're going to continue with. You know, I mean, because that's what's important, because people get on an exercise regimen and then drop off. The best kind, of course, is to do something that's self-reinforcing, that you enjoy with others, that you do outside. So something like tennis or hiking or, you know, playing a sport is just ideal. And you don't even think that you're exercising. Yeah. Then there's most of us who can't do that all the time or don't have the setup for that or don't take the energy to find that setup, who exercise in the gym. And that's because it's convenient, it's quick, you know, you can do it at your own convenience. But the important part of all this is to ritualize it so you don't miss it. That is, you know, now they're recommending from the Health and Human Services that we do it every day, most days, for 30 to 40 minutes, getting your heart rate up to about 60 to 70% of your maximum heart rate, really sort of just beneath the sweating index, if you will. Brisk walking, for instance, will get you there. But so you have to do that which is going to be best for you, that's going to keep you at it. It's best done outside. There's more benefits from being out in the open air and near nature. It's best even times six, probably, or I'm just making that up, but with others, because one, it's more enjoyable. There's more action going on. There's the benefit of the social encounter, which is key and crucial in our lives, and all these really help generate move the brain to optimal brain function.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. I used to enjoy tennis, and I still would enjoy it, but I have knee problems that are slowing me down. But what I've been doing recently is I've got an exercise bike in my garage, and I have an iPhone. I watch feature-length films on my iPhone while I'm pedaling on my bike, and I'm able to do that most days now for about 40 minutes. But I do miss...
That's what it takes, you know. Even that's where we're in now with Exer Gaming coming online with the Wii and with Dance Dance Revolution. I mean, we're sort of moving into that era where we're going to use our technology to help us stay with it, get with it, move into new realms, so that we can make our brain and psyche better.
What about the Wii? You know, I don't have a Wii. I've heard about it, and I've wondered, well, is that, you know, is that just a bunch of hype, or could it really
no,
be
it's
beneficial?
For real. It's for real. It's for real, and it's going to be for real. It can get one.
I hear you. Hard to find.
Yes, it's an 6 month wait if you don't. You can get them, I think, at eBay. One of my patients got it, but he had to pay a premium of $60 or something like that. So out there, but you can't wait. But he claims, and others too have talked about the real, you can really, there's different programs on the Wii exercise piece, but you can really get, it really can get you going.
I'm going to look into that. That sounds great. Now, what about something we haven't spoken much about yet is stress and the relationship between exercise and stress reduction.
Yes, I think that to me was the most compelling chapter in the book. I mean, even more so than the cognition in Naperville chapter. But stress is really misunderstood, and by me even going into it, because after reading all the neuroscience lately, looked at neuroscience, I've come to respect stress in a very different way, because you have to look at stress as a spectrum. And what most people talk about stress, they talk about, it's really toxic stress. It's really stress that doesn't go away, that stays with you all the time. and it's worry about your job or your kids mm-hmm. or your relationship or something that just nags you all the time. That's stress, toxic stress. There's no, but the way to really look at stress is that stress is necessary for us to live and move. Everything we do is really stress, meaning, and the best way of, I think about stress, come to appreciate it, is that when you challenge your cells in your body to do more than you would if you were just lying down, which to some people are stressful, you know, or just sitting there watching the 12th time Law and Order or something like that, you know, that is not stressing much. But everything else is really about stress, moving, learning. A lot of things we do are stressful, but they're stressed with the recovery period, and that's what's important, where you don't get that with toxic stress. You don't get that recovery, but with, for instance, lifting weights, I mean, you tax the muscle and you stress the muscle and you break it and you challenge it and you over-challenge it, but then you have a recovery period, which is what's so important, is you have this all this growth going on to make it tougher and more resilient for the next, part of your life. And the same thing happens in the brain, that if we tax the brain and you do with all kinds of exercise. Exercise taxes the brain, makes all the cells click away, just as we do with learning with some of the cells of the brain. You do the same kind of thing. You demand more of them. They have to work harder. They develop with working harder. They have breakdown products, the free radicals, all from Berkeley out near your way. You know, those free radicals that run around and cause trouble. Mm-hmm. And inside the cell, they punch holes in proteins and break up DNA and they're very much part of the aging process, but also the sort of slowing down process. Well, when you have something that you're stressing for a short period of time, you're intracellularly, you build up a resilience because you build up the internal factors to help deal with these free radicals that you make from using too much energy, using more energy than you would normally. And that's really the way to look at stress. And then with that buildup of the internal, I think of them as janitorial service, you get the antioxidant enzymes build up intracellularly. And all these great and wonderful new things that I've just learned about that help manage protein bending because of activity and putting DNA back together and all this kind of stuff that we know about now, and sort of a what we call stress inoculation, or periods of stress with ample periods of recovery, you have built up the janitorial service to help clean up the toxic mess that's going to result every time you use your cells. So you have, in this recovery period, you build up more than you need, and that's the beginning of intracellular resilience. And exercise, many of the dietary things we take in, learning, and challenging ourselves are all good ways of developing that internal resilience that will help us live longer and be more active as we go.
Well, hearing about all of this scientific support certainly helps to boost my motivation. It's a great reminder and a metaphorical shot in the arm to kind of keep going, keep exercising. Let's talk a bit about the benefits of exercising in dealing with various clinical conditions. Let's start with anxiety, which may manifest itself in a generalized way or in phobias or in panic. What evidence is there that exercise can benefit those conditions?
Oh, I think there's tons of evidence for that, and there is just a flock of evidence for the benefits for depression, for anxiety, for panic disorder. You know, part of what the real overall message is if you activate your brain with exercise, you're going to release a lot of the neurotransmitters that we aim with in psychopharmacology, you know, or drugs that we use, serotonin drugs, dopamine drugs, norepinephrine drugs, all tend to try, we think, elevate the levels of these neurotransmitters. Well, exercise does that pretty quickly. When you're moving, you're doing better. You have more dopamine circulating, more norepinephrine, and eventually more serotonin. So this is one of the quick ways of thinking about how we all these things work in the brain. And then, of course, there's more elaborate effects also.
I was interested to see that you recommend combining exercise with cognitive behavioral therapy, that it seems to make it more effective. Can you say something about that?
Well, I think it makes change more effective. Okay. That exercise helps cognitive therapy go better. And then cognitive therapy, because you can get yourselves ready to learn, right? But you have to feed them something. So, and if you feed them something that will help them change or lead them down the way of changing, that is learning something new or new strategies or trying to impose this idea when that it's okay when in the past you've been phobic to an event or to a stimulus, then you're going to be more effective at making yourselves learn that, in a much better environment. Plus, you need to have that cognitive therapy piece to solidify or to introduce and then solidify the brain to change.
Okay. Well, there are a number of clinical conditions that we could go through, but I won't march you through them all. There is certainly in the book you talk about the benefits of exercise and dealing with a range of things going from addiction to aging to ADHD and so on. But there are a couple of theoretical issues here that I wanted to touch on before I let you go. You talk about a shift from the neurotransmitter hypothesis to connectivity theory. I'm sure it's very complex, but can you briefly take us through that?
Well, this is really looking at the depressive disorders, but it relates to all the psychiatric and disorders that we deal with. And the neurotransmitter idea was when we started using antidepressants, we were looking at the neurotransmitter norepinephrine, that we were increasing norepinephrine with our early antidepressants. And everybody was over-focused on that as the problem with depression. There wasn't enough norepinephrine. So in the 70s, everybody was measuring urine to measure breakdown products of norepinephrine to try to categorize different depressions or manic depressions or whatever. And then serotonin came on the scene, especially when Prozac came out in the late 80s, as also being as important or even more important. I think it's as important as, and not really more important, but as important as norepinephrine. So I grew up in the idea that it was a neurotransmitter-based problem, that depression was, that there was something out of whack with these neurotransmitters. And more recently, what we see is depression as a brain state, that we see a big reduction in neuroplasticity, an increase in stress, and in stress teardown of the brain. So you see this brain erosion that can occur with chronic depressive disorders or manic depression or bipolar disorder. And part of what you see, and we know clinically from experience and observation, when people are depressed, they don't learn very well. They don't learn very much. They're not interested. But they're not able to log it in or encode it, that new information in. They don't. Their neuroplasticity is shut down. They're no longer able to connect nearly as those brain cells together as they once did. And in fact, they erode those connections. So, and then when you change that state with drugs or ECT or psychotherapy or cognitive behavioral therapy or whatever to bring about a change and a shift in the psychological psychiatric state and brain state, you see a return to this neuroplasticity. So, and one of the big markers in that continues to be our old friend BDNF. So, any effort by the biotech companies in the past 7 years or so has been aiming at BDNF to see how they could elevate that to, you know, to be a good antidepressant or a mood regulator. And it seems like there's a lot of worth in that and value in that. And as I said, there's nothing that we know of yet that I've seen that we would do to the brain to ourselves other than that does better at raising that and in improving our neuroplasticity other than exercise.
Right. You know, as a kind of a side note, I was fascinated to read in your chapter on depression that you were undergoing daily psychoanalysis during medical school, even as you were getting deeply involved in all this brain science. So what's your bottom line about talking therapies such as psychoanalysis today?
Oh, I think that there's still lots of room for psychotherapy and understanding and feeling connected to another person where you never did before. I mean, it wasn't just in medical school. It was in my residency and for 10 years after. So I was in, I beat out Woody Allen, I think, for the longest psychoanalysis. And it still didn't do much, but no, I mean I'm very much still very much involved with talking to patients and trying to help them understand themselves, because I think, as I say, it's not just about optimizing your brain function, but then what are you going to put in there? So I think there's still quite a lot to be gained.
Okay, well, it's time for us to wrap things up here. I wonder if there's any last thought you'd like to leave with our listeners.
Well, I do. There is. My overall mantra is to really go after those challenges and embrace them. Every challenge causes your brain to be active and stressed, and it builds for the future. So an exercise is one of those great challenges that you can do on a daily basis. If you get into that routine, if you make it part of your life, and if you see the value of it, of what it can do, because it certainly helps delay the onset of cognitive decline and helps you function at the optimal level.
Dr. John Rady, thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
I hope this interview with Dr. John Rady inspires you to get off your duff and start exercising, assuming that you are on your duff. I know some of you are already avid exercisers. I discovered Dr. Rady and his book as a result of an interview by Dr. Ginger Campbell on her Brain Science podcast. I believe I've previously mentioned that I've joined her network at sciencepodcasters.org. I'll probably post a link to this interview there, too. And by the way, I do strongly recommend the book Spark as being very, very informative and also very motivational. I certainly agree with the thrust of Dr. Rady's book. I have more energy, alertness, and optimism when I'm exercising regularly. It's exciting to know that science is discovering so many concrete benefits. And I think a growing number of mental health professionals may incorporate exercise into their treatment protocols. At least I hope they do. Unlike drugs, there are no bad side effects with exercise other than injury. So we do need to be mindful to not overdo it, to listen to our bodies, and so on. I know as a male, and maybe it's not just males, but over the years, there have been many times when I got carried away trying to be too macho and ended up injuring myself and then not being able to exercise for days, sometimes for weeks or even months. So watch out for that tendency. I've never been able to exercise at a gym. It's just too repetitive and boring, at least for me. It might be different if I had an exercise partner, but I don't. I really agree with Dr. Rady's observation about the value of exercising outdoors and with other people. And I used to be very much into first tennis and skiing and bicycling, initially mountain biking and then later road biking. Now I can't believe the amount of time and energy I put into all those long rides. I think I may have done in my knees and lower back by trying to grind up too many steep hills and mountains. At first, I couldn't handle the exercise bike, that I have in my garage. But if I'm careful not to push too hard, I can get in a good 40 minutes without my knees acting up too much. I definitely wouldn't be able to handle the boredom of it, though, without listening to podcasts or, more recently, watching feature-length movies I've downloaded onto my iPhone. I'm still searching for something a bit more social. I did Tai Chi quite religiously for several years, and then I got so busy with podcasting that I stopped going to the classes, which were a bit of a drive, and drifted away from the Tai Chi for 2 or 3 years. More recently, I've tried to get back into it, taking some classes that are closer to home, but it's a completely different style than the one I first learned, and I don't seem to be as fired up as I was the first time around and can't seem to motivate myself to do it outside of class these days. But enough about me, as they say. What about you?
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
Well, it's Friday, July 11th here, and it's G3 iPhone Day. I'm not sure yet when I'll upgrade from my first generation iPhone, but knowing me, I probably will, even if I can't get 3G service from AT&T here in Rohnert Park where I live, and I'm pretty sure I can't. But still, as I say, knowing me, I probably will upgrade. Speaking of things technological, are any of you in Second Life? Listener Elaine has purchased a beautiful property there and has created a conference space for Shrink Wrap Radio fans, and she's offering us a chance to gather for discussions there. I haven't had much time for Second Life lately, but it does seem like an idea worth exploring. If you're a Second Life resident, or want to be one, plan to be one, and you're interested, drop me an email or contact Elaine on Second Life, where she is Marlena Poliatevska. That's Marlena, and then her last name is Poliatevska. That's her name in Second Life, Marlena Poliatevska. And I'm Dr. Dave Chusen there. That's capital D, small O-C-T-O-R, capital D-A-V-E, space C-H-U-Z-E-N. Dr. Dave Chusen. So maybe we'll run into each other in Second Life, although I'm not spending much time there. I'm just too busy. But if you drop me an email and say you'd like to meet up in there, I'll try to spend more time. Boy, I'm all plugged up this morning with allergies, so you may hear me sniffing and I may sound plugged up. You might also want to listen to my interview with Dr. Mark Kern on my other podcast at www.wisecounselpodcast.com, where I talk to Dr. Mark Kern about addiction and rational alternatives to Alcoholics Anonymous. He believes that Alcoholics Anonymous or 12-step programs are not really for everybody and that there are some alternatives. And so that was an interesting discussion. Once more, I want to thank the folks who've made PayPal donations through our Top Spots widget on our site. Be sure to check them out. Boy, they've been up there for a long time. We haven't had any other people to kind of bump them down the list. So if you put your ad up there, it's going to get a lot of exposure. So please consider making a $20 donation yourself in exchange for an opportunity to promote your favorite blog or website there. Just go to shrinkwrapradio.com and look at the top right-hand side of the page and you'll see the place I'm talking about. Our list of transcripts continues to grow And so be sure to look at those and consider volunteering. The sponsors for the show are Mevio and GoDaddy. Mevio just got a third round of funding. They got another $15 million, and they've become one of the premier go-to spots on the internet, especially for video. And they're our sponsor. We're riding on their coattails. If this were a video show, I might be making some money. But quite frankly, I don't see how to turn this into an interesting video, given that the people that I interview are remote and probably don't have video access. And I'm not that pretty to look at on video. But if you've got any great ideas for me to create a successful video series, maybe separate from this, let me know. So at any rate, you can check out our GoDaddy discounts on our site at shrinkwrapradio.com by using the checkout code of SHRINK3, for example. You can get a 10% discount on all your domain name purchases at GoDaddy.com.
Hi, this is Fernando Blanco from Mexico City. You're on the couch, on a rock, on a boat, on a plane, with Dr. Dave.
Thanks, Fernando Blanco, for that transition. He sent that to me some time back. I hope he's still listening. Hey, folks, I need some new transitions. Send me your MP3 files. Now let's go to some listener email. You recall I mentioned Elaine of Second Life. She sent me an email, actually, prior to our meeting up there recently. And she wrote, "Hello there, Dr. Dave. I wanted to give you an update about learning social interactions with the use of Sims 2, which is not an online experience, but rather simply a computer simulation which runs on a PC. Now, she had previously shared with me some of her early family of origin history and some of the background that's kind of led to difficulties forming relationships over the course of her life. And so she's been working on that. And one of the interesting ways that she's found to work with that is through both Sims 2 and also Second Life. So that gives you a little bit of background on this letter. So let me start it again. I wanted to give you an update about learning social interactions with the use of The Sims 2, which is not an online experience, but rather simply a computer simulation which runs on a PC. I learned a few things via playing Sims 2. These are: it takes a while to develop a friendship with a person who I've just met. I also find this to be true in real life as well. Playing Sims 2 revealed this to me in a way that IRL interactions haven't. I guess that means real life interactions haven't. The issues I've had in real life have been an assumption that everyone would love to be friends, and also that from the moment I meet someone that we will have great interactions. Reality intrudes, and what I've learned from playing The Sims 2 is that it's important to allow an acquaintance with a new person time to develop and not dump lots of information on someone in the first few times that we meet. Isn't that great learning? It's wonderful that that can happen through a video game. She goes on to say, the other thing is that new acquaintances have their own established network of friends and interests, and that they may know nothing about me. Others will be more cautious than I really expect as far as building a friendship. After all, their particular life is a wide palette of things that they commonly relate to, and I won't be part of that right away. Also, I know myself really well. However, they don't know that yet, so it's important to give it time for friendship to develop or not, as the case may be. Disclosure in steps seems to be more important than a big memory dump on someone. That's great learning. She goes on to say, asking the other person to share and disclose first is more effective than sharing my information with them first. Getting to know about them first and what they are about is more constructive for both parties in the interaction. As far as the Sims 2 simulator, it's not really effective as the other avatars are not actual people. Also, even the adult Sims require way too much maintenance, such as reminding them to visit the bathroom or to take showers or to make meals. Adults, especially even adult Sims, should not have to be maintained to such a degree that it takes up all your time. I've expanded my social network in real life by going back to college after retirement and now have completed a set of classes, and she mentions a local junior college, in order to be a radio announcer, and she mentions the station. I'm starting my on-air training by being assigned to an experienced DJ, and I'm on 10 p.m. to the 2 a.m. shift on Wednesdays. How exciting that is for you. Wow, you're on real radio. I wish I were on real radio. But podcasting's international, and that's a good thing about that. She goes on to say, I'm also working on additional social skills to apply in real life by joining Second Life. In Second Life, the other avatars are actual people in lieu of computer-generated simulations. I've been a resident there for a couple of weeks and have purchased two small adjacent parcels at a cheap price and joined them together, then placed a really nice home on it. And as an aside, I visited her really nice home, and it's true, it's incredible. She says it would be really nice to invite you as a friend on Second Life. However, since I don't know your Second Life name, I'll share mine. It's Marlena Poliatevska. And I've already just shared mine. It's Dr. Dave Schusen, or Chusen. So she goes on to say, so when you visit Second Life next time, please send a friend invite. And we already did that. We've met there now. And she says, if other Second Life members, if other listeners are Second Life members, perhaps we can form a shrink wrap radio group. You're also more than welcome to share this email with the listening audience on your Shrink Wrap radio show. Regards and best wishes to you. I love your program and listen regularly, Elaine. So that's what a wonderful email that is. And thanks for sharing deeply your own journey of learning, of social learning, Elaine. Yeah, I think that kind of sharing is the kind that actually helps one to form new relationships. So I think that better wrap it up in terms of our email for today. Remember, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave voice comments as well as transitions on our voicemail on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod, or on our message number, which is 206-337-0622. Or you can leave your voicemails on the MyChingo facility that we have on our website. Thanks again to Dr. John Rady for sharing his research insights on exercise and the brain. My next guest will be Rabbi Emmanuel Yosef Yablonsky, who's doing interesting work on post-traumatic stress disorder in Israel. Until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.